Hey, welcome to the Meat House. Jeff here.
Chris here.
Chris, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's been a good summer. It's gotten hot enough. I'm going to start my Quebec.
Yes.
Quebec. I'm going to get that right.
I might be butchering the name too.
Okay.
For all I know.
Well, one day I'll try to get it right. At least we match. But I'm finally getting ready to do that. I'm going to make myself a citrus note, the Voss that has the citrus notes on the side.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make it for a lemon.
Nice.
Lemon meat.
Nice.
So your lemon meat you had a while back got me going on that.
Yeah. Hey, remember again, you need a lot of nutrient for that, but we're getting into that time of year where, you know, you can just stick it on the back porch and let it go.
And, you know, so expect calls. I will be going, yeah. All right. Well, off in Meat House, everybody. First of all, we want to thank all the people who listen to us every week.
Absolutely.
We really appreciate it. We are perfectly content to talk amongst ourselves, but we're really glad you came to join us.
It's always nice to have an audience for this kind of stuff. And, you know, the engagement and interaction is huge. We appreciate you guys tuning in. And hey, for those of you guys that have been, you know, following the links to our website or following us on Facebook and things like that, we're making it a little easier for you guys to
listen and tune in.
This
is awesome.
So in the past few weeks, we've gotten a lot more
platforms
activated on directories and stuff like that. So now you can find The Meat House on Apple Podcasts, on Pocket Cast, iHeartRadio, which is the one I use, Pandora. You can find us on Deezer, Podcast Addict. Podcast Addict is the one I use, not iHeartRadio. Sorry, pitching the wrong guys.
I'm going to be subscribing to all these things just so I can engage all of us there.
We're on Player FM. We're on Podchaser. We're on CastBox. We're on Good Pods. We're on Podcast Index. Like, apart from Spotify and Amazon Music, which are big and therefore take a little while longer to get, like, activated and moving on.
And we're working on it.
It's in progress.
Yes.
But you have options for finding us. And, yeah, no, it's just so much easier than having to follow a link and listen on the website or whatever every week you've been doing.
And it's very likely you're probably one or more of these in the beginning. I can find us there.
Exactly.
And you're already there.
Yeah, no. And guys, like, if you are on, you know, Apple Podcasts or whatever, subscribe, leave us a review and things like that to really help engagement. Cause like I've mentioned before, we've seen the numbers climb since we got this thing restarted. And, that is huge because that's all organic. That's you guys like listening and sharing and things like that and finding us on, Facebook or, the places we're kind of like active on, but the ability for you to go, hey, you know, subscribe to us on Apple, and so other people that are interested in meat can find us that way.
Yeah, awesome.
That much easier for everybody involved.
And I'm going to give full marks to Jeff on this one. He's the one that did most of this, because apparently when it comes to technology, I'm all thumbs. Because I tried to, you know, I said, I've got trouble with this. Jeff says, oh, here. Okay. Now you're just showing off. But that's okay. I'm glad we're here. Now, the other person we talk about here is Bacchus and Barleycorn.
Yes. Absolutely. They have been our sponsor since we got this thing back and up and running. They are a fantastic resource for homebrewers. Whether you need the information, the ingredients, the equipment, they got it all.
And they are very, yes, they'll cheer you on.
They are friendly as all get out. I think we are missing the July customer appreciation weekend to record here.
Yeah, we are, but
a little behind.
Yeah. But you know, life gets in the way. I mean,
it really does. But yeah, no, Bacchus and Barleycorn is such a great resource for the average home brewer. And when certain online stores, which just had a big sale and we will not mention by name, are kind of gobbling up all the competition, you know, it's great to have people that are actually like engaged and, you know, small businesses like this working and doing their thing. They are such a big part of the community that it, like having them on board with us
is just great.
Huge. And hey, if you guys are shopping online, you can follow the link to their store in the show notes and use our code MHP10. For 10% off of your purchases. They're already competitive, but it's just a little extra to show them, hey, you're listening and you appreciate what they're doing for us and giving you a little bit of something on the
upside. Back end. Yeah, that's great. But today, you know, a lot of great news we've had so far. It's been a busy summer for us.
Yeah, it really has.
We've been pretty...
Just meat stuff.
Not just meat stuff,
but other stuff.
It's just been insane, but, you know, Jeff and I really enjoy doing this, so we carve out time where necessary. But today I want to talk about bochet mead or honey or toasted honey meads, because this is something very near and dear to me. I have failed 3 times with this so far. I have made ash flavored mead 3 times so far.
No bueno, no bueno.
It, but I hope I've learned enough to do make it number four good. But we want to help you so maybe you don't mess up as much as I did.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of the different ways to toast or caramelize your honey, and kind of some guidance as far as approaches go and things like that. Hey, before we get to that topic though, let's talk about our meat of the day.
Meat of the day. This is actually something that's came up as a new oaked type of mead
Yeah,
that we've heard about recently.
we heard about this at
The Valkyrie Horn.
and
It's a new oak. What was the name of the oak? Really?
Ambarana.
Ambarana oak.
If I remember right, this is from like Brazil or South America. I could be wrong. But this is from Sap House, actually. This is Moon Stood Still, which is wildflower honey with blueberries, and it has been aged for 2 months in an Ambarana oak barrel.
So, now I will tell you the color is brilliantly red.
Yeah, this is a blueberry mead for sure. Kind of a dark ruby color. Does it cheat or have legs? I think it.
Pretty spousey legs.
Yeah, it's got some. If anything, it's got some really narrow legs. I think it's mostly sheeting glass for me.
Wow, that smell.
Oh, that's a good blueberry smell, though.
Holy cow. Oh my. Ew.
Little alcohol on the end of that smell.
Mostly just blueberry right up front. I can taste the oak. The oak is. The blueberry hits first, but very quickly after that oak flavor hit me. Really strong across the tongue. If you're not accustomed to oaked wines or meads, this is going to throw you for a loop. This has got a strong, powerful oak flavor in it.
Yeah, now I'm just looking up some notes on Ambarana here because I, Valkyrie's Horn was back in February. So I, and I was already a little schmitzy for that educational talk because, I had been judging all day.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm seeing that Ambarana note has, sorry, it has notes of cinnamon, vanilla, and spice, and also is believed to have preservative properties to help prolong the aging process and contribute to the development of complex flavors.
And that very
So,
strong oak flavor that is a very powerful cinnamon flavor. Now, you mentioned the name, I made that connection really fast.
it's not like red hot cinnamon. It's kind of like that baking spice cinnamon,
Yeah.
for sure.
Well,
And
that's probably why I missed it.
it plays real nicely with the blueberries in this too.
Yeah, I
This
mean,
is, I would say this is off-dry to semi-sweet, really, but.
But I will say that the blueberries do play a second note to the cinnamon, but they're not absent by any stretch.
No, it's just potent. And usually with these barrel projects we've seen from Sap House, we're talking about leaving, they're talking about leaving stuff in barrels for months at a time.
This one was two, so it's not very long,
Right. Yeah. I think that
but
it's just a,
I think he pulled it the right time.
yeah, this is just a very potent thing. And, generally speaking, also, I have a feeling this was a, like a virgin barrel, so to speak, that they hadn't been used for anything else. Whereas I think a lot of their other barrel projects, they're using stuff that has had spirits in it before. So like, it'll be a whiskey barrel or a rum barrel, or like my favorite that, I would love to try and replicate sometime is the, what they call it, Smoky Pete, where they had a, they smoked the honey with, I can't remember if it was like an oak smoke or a peat smoke, and then they aged it in a Islay Scotch barrel, so it was a scotchy kind of mead. And I actually have a bottle of it upstairs in my kitchen, but it's bottle two or three from batch one, and I'm not going to open it.
Gotcha. Okay, fair.
Because it's kind of like, ooh, that's
Yeah.
that's a little bit of history right there. I'm gonna just hold on to that.
Yeah. Okay, now Sap House is actually, is one of Jeff's and has become quickly becoming one of my favorite mead
Yeah.
subscribers. So this is not they don't they're not a sponsor or anything, but if you want a solid mead on a fairly regular basis, I
Their mead club is five stars, recommend.
Yeah, it's really good.
I feel like you get consistently four bottles. They're all 375s. You get one or two that are, what do I want to say, like crowd pleasers. Like when you, the fall, I usually get something in the neighborhood of like the Kith or Kin. Kith and Kin, like baking spice one, or a like an apple pie, cherry pie, blueberry pie kind of mead. And then you get a couple weird ones that are like, you know, fun experiments of different like foraged flavors and stuff like that. It kind of hits all those notes that I'm excited about when it comes to mead making. And so, yeah. And when we had the tech to do like call-ins and things like that, we had Ash on the show, Ash Fishbein, the owner of Sap House, a few times. He's solid dude, really great with, you know, providing a little bit of insight and information as to his process and the process that his guys are using. Of course, obviously he's got Sap House. He's got Hobbs Brewing, a beer brewing place up there. He's got a couple other interests out in, like, I want to say Brazil or Argentina that he's started up as well. So,
wow.
Busy guy.
Busy guy.
In addition, like, I see some of his posts on Facebook where he's, like, you know, gathering actual maple syrup sap and boiling that down for just for, you know, his own family usage, I think. And, like, cool. That's, you know, that's the kind of, like, homesteading.
Yeah.
I like the idea.
Now I want to start meeting these people. And I have to drag you along with me. anyway, so Bochet honey.
Yeah.
Bochet and honey. It simply means you're removing water from the honey to make a more caramel or toffee-like
flavor. Well, yes. And we are also caramelizing some of those sugars. I think if you remember, it was last week, I think, we talked about hops in mead.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about how when you're, again, that word of the day, isomerizing the hops, what you're basically doing is you're using the heat to fold those proteins so they work differently. They stop being an alpha acid in this case and start being a bittering compound instead. And in the same way, you're taking some of the proteins in these, you know, glucose, fructose kind of sugars, and you're bending them a little bit. So you get that Maillard reaction, like the same thing that makes toast taste good, essentially.
Okay. Gotcha.
The sear on a steak. It's all that Maillard reaction where the heat kind of transforms stuff. And so the weird thing about Bochet is that you are making a small percentage of your sugars unfermentable. They're going to stick around. They're going to be, you know, in the mead, but they're going to add flavor. So it's fine. It's fine.
Okay. Once upon a time we talked about when there are like 100 compounds in honey that make honey taste
right
like this.
Mm-hmm.
How much do you lose with the heat process on that? Do you have a clue?
I don't think you're losing much. Well, so some of them are volatile aromatics, and there are a number of people out there that say, like, hey, don't heat your honey above 95 degrees or you're going to lose some of those flavor compounds, right?
Yeah, I've heard that.
You're probably going to lose some in the process of making this, depending on your process.
Okay.
So the other thing you need to understand, though, is that, again, changing these sugars. So some of the flavor compounds are not being eliminated. They're just changing.
Okay.
And the fun thing that I've heard of a number, honestly, I've not really taken the opportunity to try like varietal honey Bochets or caramelizations, but I've been told that you still get the varietal character in the honey after it's caramelized, or you get different character from it, rather than just, you know, your usual like wildflower or clover kind of blends that are kind of like the base building blocks for most of our meats, right?
Okay. I may take a small amount of the honey I'm getting from the Pacific North, because the Pacific Northwest, because they do the metal foam up there.
Mm-hmm.
I was gonna order some. They said their bees went a little far afield, and they got hold of blueberry flowers in the process of getting them. And I'm sitting here, well, if you insist on discounting that for me, because I'm getting exactly what I want, they didn't discount. But I still got some. So we'll see how that works out.
I mean, blueberry's nice. Meadow foam's nice. The two of them together still sounds nice.
Doesn't sound bad.
Still sounds nice.
Yeah, so maybe try Bochet a little bit of that, see what happens with that. See if we get that marshmallow blueberry flavor.
Yeah, a little half pint or pint or something like that. Yeah. Could be okay. Yeah, we'll just see what we get out of that.
Okay, now when Bochet and honey, I'm gonna do a tangent a little bit later. I just thought of this, but Bochet, what is the ways to do it other than a pot on a stove? I've done the pot on the stove.
Yeah,
and I failed twice with that.
Pot on a stove is like the basic. Hey, we're gonna boil something. Let's put a pot on a stove and boil it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen people like do like basically the Dutch oven pot on a campfire, like a what do they call it, like a cauldron kind of thing on a campfire, just because, hey, if it goes into the campfire, it's easier to clean up. Basically, I don't have to.
Sure.
Yeah, that's one way to do it. I think the problem with doing it that way is that when honey actually boils, it like easily quadruples in volume.
Oh, yeah.
Right? The boil over possibilities, and then
I had like, a 3.5 quart pot and I put a quart in and it boiled over. It boiled over. And was,
so I don't have to.
That was my stove. That was a lot of
cleanup. Cleanup sucks, too.
Yeah, it does.
Honey by itself is not fun to clean up. Honey that's been kind of scorched and caramelized. It's just there's effort involved. Yeah. It's not my preferred way to do this. My preferred way to do this is with a crock pot.
Okay.
The other way I've heard of people doing it is with a pressure cooker. I haven't tried that myself.
But you got a crock pressure cooker recently. You're going to give that a try now?
Yes, I might give that a try now. We're getting, as we get closer to the fall and winter months, I think those to me feel like Boucher time of year, right?
Boucher time of year is, when I'm drinking it, not so much when I'm making it. Sorry.
One of us is less picky than the other,
apparently. Yeah, a little bit.
Well, anyway. So the crock pot is my preferred way to do this because it's just a lot easier to control. You don't actually reach a boil with the crock pot. The bear of it is it takes a long time to do. Generally speaking, what I'll do is fill the crock pot like a quarter to a half full of honey, and I'll set it on high, and I'll just leave it.
On high?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Uncovered on high.
Okay.
We do want to remove water, so if you have a cover on it, if you have the lid on your crock pot, a lot of that steam vapor will rise and then collect and then fall back in. So you get faster results on the order of like 4 to 6 hours instead of 8 to 12 if you've got the lid off.
Lesson learned.
Right.
Lesson learned.
So, you don't want to leave this alone or leave it like unattended because you're keeping an eye on the flavor profile and the color profile. Once it starts to change, it's one of those like, it's an exponential kind of thing. Okay. So to get like,
the more that goes out, the faster the rest goes.
Right. So that first like big color change, like the first noticeable color change, that might take you 2 or 3 hours all by itself. Like the next major change in color that you notice, that might be another hour.
And so on.
Right. Yeah. The more water you're removing, the faster the rest of it kind of goes. And obviously it's honey, it's water, it's sugar. It has like a thermal mass, I guess is the term for it. So that kind of builds over time and holds on to that heat in there, and it builds and builds on itself. So it is a cascade effect, and you got to keep an eye on it. So this is one of those things of like, hey, stick this in your kitchen. I think the last time I did a Boucher like this, I batched out something like 45 breakfast burritos for my family to stick in the freezer and heat up later. I made the eggs, then I made the sausage, then I warmed up the tortillas, and I put it all together, and I wrapped them, and I wrapped them in foil, and I labeled them all, and that took like 2 hours. So just keeping myself busy while I was waiting for things to kick off and get going. And then I sat and, watched some Netflix or something for a little while and kept an eye on it. And it's one of those things you kind of have to be home and around and aware of, but it doesn't take very much attention. And now I've heard of some people also using, like, I don't know if you've seen them, they have like thick plastic liners for crock pots.
Yeah,
like,
I've seen them,
if you're making like a chicken or something in there, you're boiling it. I've heard of some people using those because when you're done with the Boucher process, then you just quickly clean it out.
Yeah.
And with that, and you have a bag that's easy to transport and you can just like, tip off the side or cut a corner off of and pour it into your fermenter. That seems like a good thing, but that plastic is also going to be an insulator.
It's going to take longer to get it done.
So it's going to take a while to kick off. It's going to take longer to go. That's kind of been one of the reasons I've not really tried that. And, the other thing to think about when we're doing this is, and one of the reasons I like crock pots, is that you get direct control over how much caramelization you're getting into your honey. Some people like kind of a burnt orange color. Some people want to go black. I don't go like crispy black, But
I went kind of dark, and I mean, tastes like ash. That was my problem. I mean, I went past the burnt orange to dark.
Well, and you did it on the stove, right?
The first two I did, yeah.
And so my sweet spot that I'm looking for with this that I've just done and enjoyed, if you compare it to like making hard candy, I would call it like softball stage, where like if you're making a hard candy sugar, or like a caramel, and it cools down, you get like the chewy kind of caramel bits, where it's thick, but you can shape it into a ball. You can make a little like candy that way with it, not necessarily like a hard candy level of caramelization.
So okay, the color is how much water has escaped, I take.
And how much of that,
Has been toasted.
right, how much of the sugars have been caramelized?
And how far is too far? I mean, crispy black obviously is too far. What's the end you're looking for?
My,
Or what should I say is too far?
if you're getting more burnt character than you're getting caramel character, you've gone too far. And I realize that's not very helpful when we're making, 5 pounds of honey caramelized.
Yeah, because
Said, oh,
that's
I've ruined this.
yeah, that's
Now it's time to restart an
eight
8 hour
hour process.
process.
So, okay, when should you start taking a closer look? What color or consistency should you have for when you start taking when you're just not leaving the area?
This is, once you get to that burnt orange flavor, that might be your time to pull it. You might want to go darker. You might want to go like Coca-Cola is kind of a color that I would call pretty good on the
Okay,
outside.
that kind of surprised me. That's really
That's
dark.
pretty dark. What a lot of people will do is they will take a white plate and just make some, like a paper plate, make some notes, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hour, and get popsicle sticks.
Yeah,
Or,
cripple
right. And that way you see color change, and you can, obviously, you don't want to put near boiling honey in your mouth immediately,
on.
right? You can let it cool
Yeah,
so you
just
can get a
a
taste.
lot.
Yeah. And that way you kind of get a note of where your flavor is going. And that's, I think that's another reason why I like using the crock pot, because I get to kind of taste as I go. It's a little delayed, but not very much. If I let that popsicle stick with honey on it sit for 2 or 3 minutes to cool down, and then I can get a warm little bit of honey and say, okay, well, then we're getting there, getting there. That, I think, stovetop, you could kind of do that, but you're boiling the honey at that point, and that exponential curve is going a lot faster. And so I don't necessarily like doing it that way. And if you're doing the pressure cooker method, you don't really get to stop and say, okay, well, I think we're done.
It's either you stop and you're done, or you're whether you are or not.
Right. I think you would, if you tried to put the jars of honey back into the pressure cooker and pressure cook them a little bit more, you would way overshoot. So yeah, I feel like that one you're kind of dialing it in and you're guessing to some extent and saying, okay, well, we're gonna do this 15 PSI for 15 minutes and see what we get.
That
And
doesn't work that way with that one.
you might like 15 PSI at 15 minutes, but you don't get to put it in for another 5 later and assume that's going to be a good goal. It, like the next time you try it, maybe we're going to do 15 PSI for 20 minutes to get more, or 15 PSI for 12 to get a little less. We're dialing it in batch by batch instead of, moment by moment and taste by taste. So again, that's why I prefer the crock pot for doing this.
Okay, when we talk about this a little, I also looked up real quick of like the hot, honey hot boxes.
Okay.
Have you heard of this?
For beekeeping, I've heard of this.
Okay, for the honey, okay, this is what I got from Tracy
Okay.
down in Texas. She has a box that she has outside of her porch that she puts the honey in, and it gradually raises the temperature. And at a certain point, time, something, she didn't tell me details, she just takes it out. And it sounds like a crock pot, but in a hot box or fermenter.
It kind of sounds like a solar cooker, really.
Yeah.
And it's like for beekeepers, they do something similar where they have like, if you've ever seen the educational video about how they harvest honey, like they take like a hot knife and cut the caps off all of them, and then they spin out the frames and put the frames back in. All those caps have honey on them, It's not just wax. Mm-hmm. And so what they'll do is a lot of beekeepers will have, like, basically it's a solar cooker with a little tilted pan. They put all the cappings that they've collected into that solar pan. The honey and the wax melt, they separate. And so you get, like, layers, essentially. And you can take the wax off and make, you know, candles, or sell it to violinists and things like that, and whatever you're going to do with your wax. And you've got some honey left over that you can add to your supplies, or you can, I think some people will sell that separately because it is a little bit bouched in that process.
I don't know if this was a solar panel or plug-in or what,
but
it was actual dedicated box is what the impression I got when she talked about
it. And it sounds like it's a slow heating process. It might be solar, it might be electric, but we're in that kind of that same idea of slowly heating up the honey and getting, you know, it. She might be going for a specific temperature of honey, which makes sense because that kind of will correlate to a certain level of caramelization. Whatever your process for finding that right sweet spot of the flavor you like in this, go for that.
Yeah, you're going to be, you know, doing some testing race to get there.
Yeah, I think this is a personal preference kind of situation for a lot of bee makers, I think, because some people will like a heavier caramelization than others. Like we were talking about, I tend to go pretty dark with this.
You like more toffee.
Than the
caramel.
So those like toffee and raisiny character notes you get from heavily caramelized honey, those are kind of my jam. This will be good in like a stout braggot, for example, that also uses dark grain and some more like light floral hops and stuff like that. I've used that a couple times, or, you know, just in general, the darker bochet with a little like vanilla and oak is pretty nice to me. So this is one of those you have to kind of dial in, but there are different ways of doing it. I'm sticking with my crock pot. And honestly, like if you have a crock pot at home, you probably don't want to use that for this. You probably want to go to the Goodwill or another like secondhand store
and get a cheap
old one that you're not going to mind destroying.
Yeah, because your chances are pretty good. You sound like you're good.
Yeah, this is not fun to clean up.
Well,
pour it into a secondary container while it's still very warm, because otherwise,
you're trying
honey,
to pull.
Honey is thick by itself. Once you've caramelized it, like I told you before, you get to like softball candy, which, as I'm sure you can imagine, does not scrape out of a crock pot easily. So, this is one of those things you kind of want to, and it wouldn't hurt to like let your honey cool down a little bit so it is still liquid-ish. Pour that into your fermenter and have some of your gallon jugs of spring water in the fridge or the freezer to just be cold and get yourself to a fermenting temperature easy that way.
That
might be the strategy you want to go with here, so you don't have to. Your cleanup is going to be a lot easier if you can get most of that crud out of a very warm to hot crock pot rather than let it cool down.
Have specific tools for the job, leave them where they are. Bouching, I'm excited about bouching. Mm-hmm. I just have so far been unsuccessful with my bouching. It's going a little dark on me, actually.
The first one I did was just a little gallon batch, and I stuck a nice little vanilla bean pod in it and let it sit. And I was very pleased with it. And like one of my friends that got to try it in one of my gaming groups was like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. Hey, I'm getting married in 6 months. Can you make a batch of this for the wedding? And I'm like, yeah, sure, I can do that. And then he decided he needed to go to AA.
That's just mean. That's a cruel joke there. Oh, well, you know, good for him.
Yeah.
No, so nothing but support, but,
you know.
Then you had to drink your own.
I know, right?
The travesty. The travesty. Oh, my God.
Drink my own mead?
Yeah, I'm hurt. You didn't tell me about it. Anyway, so a question came up recently, and this is completely off topic of the honey.
Right.
I'm going to move on to another topic. The question came up. A gentleman had his mead stall.
Or near stall.
He got really slow. I showed you that. And he said that he made one large batch and put it into two smaller batches. One that had more water in it did not stall. And one that had less water, it stalled on it.
Yeah, it sounds like there was a dilution issue where, you know, the second one, the one that is stalling, was not quite as diluted as the first one. And okay. So there are possibilities here.
Okay. So how do we can correct this if somebody out there is listening to us?
So
has something similar.
In this case, I would say, yeah, just get some and go as what do I want to say, sterile or like objectively not introducing stuff to your mead as possible, and try a little dilution there. If that's the,
Just spring water.
I would try like roty or distilled, honestly. Usually we don't want to use that, but like anything that has been through a mechanical process to remove things like chlorine and chloramine and you know, the crud in the water will also generally remove bacteria. So I think it's a little safer to do it that way.
Okay.
If you're
This
getting
did to make a stall, not to get started.
the, yeah, for making mead, obviously we've talked about before, I will say it again, use spring water because
Yeah.
spring water has that minerality to it that just tends to make yeast or to make yeast that tends to just make mead better.
It's very, I mean, I've done both, and the difference is subtle, but there is a more pleasant, it's not a taste,
Right.
it's a more pleasant sensation when drinking that mead.
Well, and you know, it, depending on what part of the country you're in, you can also use tap water. You just have to treat it with the Cannon tablets or something first and let that sit for like a day and a half. But like around here, we are basically in a karst geology where there's limestone all over the damn place. Our tap water is
Hard.
hard, but that's good for mead. That calcium in the water, yeah, that actually helps flavor-wise quite a bit. And you know, I don't remember exactly when it was. It might have been like 10, 12 years ago at one point, but like the Independence tap water, just a little south of here where we're recording, was judged best tasting water in the nation.
Wow. Okay.
So, you know,
There you go.
start with something nice.
But okay, so let's say we got water from here in our area with the limestone and all that we have. Do you throw the tablets in with it?
Yes, you still want to do that because tap water has chlorine or chloramine in
Yeah.
it, just as a basic like public safety issue, and those get weird funky off flavors if they interact with the mead. So you want to throw in the Camden tablets. In this case, they're not hunting for bacteria and crap like that. They're hunting for that calcium and that chloramine. They're hunting for that chlorine
Chlorine.
and chloramine.
Thank you. Yeah.
And what they're going to do is they're going to
I
bind
am
with that.
way ahead of you on this meet, and this is just not fair to you.
I tell you, man. I tell you, they will bind with those, and basically they'll decompose into a gas and just push that out the
Okay.
top. That's it's a nice little, you know, scientific process for that we can do easily. I think it's easier to just buy spring water, but you can do that.
Yeah, well, I have a whole bunch of excess 5 gallon jugs that I got from my brother-in-law. I could just fill them up, throw a sea tablet in there, and
Or you could make more mead that we could use for a mead distilling experiment this fall.
ooh, decisions,
I know,
decisions.
right?
I think I'm going for B. Plan B sounds good.
Plan B sounds good.
I
Plan
like
B
B.
sounds
Plan
good.
B.
Anyway, that's besides the point. We're talking about stalls. So, in this case, this specific example, he's got like two, and one was a little more diluted, and it's working better. In that case, yeah, let's dilute it and see what happens. That seems like a good first step.
Oh, okay. I know that if there's too much sugar
Yeah.
in the yeast struggles.
Yes, we've talked about osmotic pressure,
Yeah.
and it's the same idea as like why they can find, you know, 3,000-4,000-year-old honey in Egyptian tombs and it's still edible because honey is sugar with water removed, so it's hydrophilic in a way that like if bacteria or yeast or mold touches it, it just sucks that water out of the cells and says no.
Yeah, but saying, in my when I read the article, when I read this page, I would have thought, okay, it stalled. Yes, I get that. I thought it would eventually pick back up. Would it have?
Maybe. And so in this case, it seems like it's not completely stalled, it's just slowed down. And when we're talking about stalls in general, let's move away from this specific example and talk about how to deal with stalls in general. What do you think we should check?
First thing I would check is the amount of yeast. I mean, was there enough?
That's a good point. Generally, my pitch rate is about 2 grams of yeast per gallon. And if some people will go as low as a gram or less than that, so it wouldn't hurt to try repitching yeast. We could, and this is another thing that we should talk about at some point, but I'm not really I need to refresh my own like process on it because I'm not sure I have a full like conversational understanding of it, but there are such things as kill factors in yeast, where a yeast can be kind of kill factor positive, kill factor negative, or kill factor indifferent. And so combining two yeasts or pitching a different kind of yeast on top of an existing yeast can lead to problems where a kill factor positive will absolutely go after a kill factor negative, and you're kind of contradicting yourself because you put a predator in with your prey, basically.
Well, I
So
wasn't thinking about
that's.
making different yeast. I was thinking about I'd add a little more yeast to it to see if that if it was just stalling out or something happened to the yeast in the process.
And adding another little like couple grams of a sachet of yeast isn't a terrible idea. It might not be terribly effective though.
Okay.
So, for me, when I'm experiencing a stall, and it's been a while since I've had one
The
because like
next thing I would have done was a hydrometer check.
hydrometer check is not a terrible idea because let's make sure that you're actually experiencing a stall.
Yeah.
If you are using like the basic plastic buckets that you and I use so many
All the
times,
time.
those have like a rubber grommet on the inside that where like the top of the bucket and the bottom of the lid contact each other, and it's supposed to be an air seal. Make sure that air seal is intact, because if you're saying I have a stall because you're not seeing airlock activity, you could just have a situation where the air is finding an easier way to escape than through the airlock.
That's fair. I
And
didn't think of that one.
I've talked to a number of people who've had exactly that problem. So, again, the basic process: do a hydrometer check, make sure that the is that gravity reading stable? Is it stable over like 3 or 4 days? If you do a gravity check and 3 days later the gravity has not moved, you're either finished fermenting or you're in a stall.
Okay.
Absolutely. If it's still moving, you might just have a sluggish start. And stuff like, adding a little water to dilute a high gravity mead, for example, that might be all the kick in the butt you need. Another thing I would seriously suggest everyone do, because it was a game changer for me in terms of not dealing with stalls: degassing that first week.
Yeah, just stir it.
Yeah, stir it, get some of the, because yeast are microscopic, and the little bubbles of CO2 they fart out, they're microscopic too.
Yeah.
They will absolutely bond to the water and create carbonic acid, but it's real easy to deal with that because you can just agitate the mead, whether it's giving your fermenter a gentle like swirl shake, or putting your little paint
Paint mixer
stirrer
thing,
thing in there.
or even just tapping on the sides to knock it all, knock it, get it going. It takes a long time,
It
but
takes more tapping, but yeah, there's different ways to do this gently to get some of that CO2 agitated out of your batch, and that absolutely will prevent stalls. I've seen no stalls since I started doing that regularly. I think that was my biggest problem. So another thing I will say when you're looking at stalls: check your pH.
okay, think of that.
Yeah, if your pH is below 3, you might be having a problem.
Okay.
If it's way below 3, you're probably having a problem with
Okay.
pH. You're probably, yeah, check your pH. If it's way below 3, you're probably having a problem with acid, and it's stopping the yeast from doing their thing. So those are some good tips. As far as a restarting from a stall, you've got a couple options, and you can either use like the yeast you started with, which is generally a good thing to do, especially if you're determined that it still has the potential alcohol to take it to completion. Let's say we stalled out at what would be an 8% alcohol, but we're using like 71B that has a 14% potential alcohol, and we made a recipe that was intended to be a 12%.
Yeah.
We've got room in this yeast, so we could easily just get that 71B out of the stall. Generally, when we talk about rehydrating yeast, we talk about, we'll use like a quarter to a half a cup of warm-ish water in like 80 to 90 degrees, and we'll add, a little packet of yeast and some Gopherm. We're going to do that again. And this time, after we've got some proofing, some bubbles, whatever you want to call that, a good way to make a starter is to do one of two things. Either you can add like some apple juice. That's obviously, we've talked before, apple juice just wants to ferment.
Yeah, I mean, it will do without help.
Right. Yeah, don't check and make sure you're not using something with sorbates or stuff like that that will just poison the yeast and stop it from working further. But that is a sugar source, and it's a natural, easy to digest sugar source that you'll get going.
It's also diluted properly for itself.
Exactly.
Like I said, when you have apple juice, you leave it in a warm, dark area. If you just leave it alone, that's going to be expanded for, it won't take long.
Yeah. You can also get like a yeast starter kit from Bacchus. They have a little sachet of maybe 10 grams of dry malt extract. Mm-hmm. It's a beer. It's not yeast.
It's just malt.
Yeah, it's the malt. It's the sugar from the grain.
Okay, gotcha.
And you can mix that up, but apple juice. It's easy. It's mead. And a little bit of apple flavor in a mead is not going to notice.
And you're probably not going to ever taste it.
So right.
It's pretty neutral.
If we're talking about like making a quarter to a half cup starter, we want about half as much apple juice. So like an eighth to a quarter cup of apple juice in there and let that go. The other option you have is to do the same amount of your mead. And I think the advantage of doing it with the mead that is stalled out is that you can see if there is something in that mead above and beyond just the yeast not doing their thing that is preventing it from working. Mm-hmm. Because if you add, you know, a quarter cup of your mead must to that half cup starter and it stops bubbling away, you got something worse in there than, you know, just yeast that doesn't want to do their thing.
Okay, so I think next time we do an episode here, I'm going to talk about using fruit juices and such.
Right, right.
Because I want to talk to you about flavoring meats. Mm-hmm. I mean, I almost never do a trad.
Right.
I mean, it's rare. I have nothing against them. I simply like my flavors.
You know, if I have an interesting varietal honey, I like a trad.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, I don't buy enough, you know, varietal honeys in interesting flavors to just do a trad.
Yeah.
Usually.
I mean, I have nothing against a trad. A good trad is a good trad, flat out. But I'm looking for every other flavor I can find.
Right. Usually if I come up with an idea for a mead, it's, I'm going to do this mead with this flavor and maybe a tertiary flavor.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I'm going to do a trad. And maybe I should do trads because you can't hide behind a shitty trad. A shitty trad is like a shitty lager. If you don't do it right, it will show.
Yeah. And that's awesome, but most of the time I want to hide.
I like the contrasts and the combinations and the little, oh, this and that and this and that.
And that undertone of this.
Mm-hmm. The things that make it complicated and interesting are kind of like the thing I like to experiment with. Right.
Kind of jam. Yeah. Both of us. We love the, and plus there's so many things you can do with flavor. We love. Okay, that's another show.
Yeah,
getting a stall, pH would be your number one indicator?
Yeah, pH, gravity. Make sure that it is actually stalled by checking your gravity at least 2, if not 3 days apart. Check your pH and see if it's way low. Obviously, we talked in the false episode. You know, you can get like potassium carbonate, bicarbonate. I forget which one it is. I think it's potassium bicarbonate or calcium carbonate, but calcium carbonate is just baking soda, and it will kind of taste like baking soda. Potassium bicarbonate is more flavor neutral, and you can use that to bring up your pH relatively quickly if you need to. So you could potentially end the stall that way, or just agitate it in the first place so you don't need to worry about it falling that rapidly. In that case, again, they either use like the new starter with apple juice or your must and get it going. And I would do 2 or 3, you know, terms of this, of like, hey, add another quarter cup of apple juice or must, let it sit for another half hour, let it build up and let it build up a strong colony. That way you've got a substantial amount you are pitching back into your must. But so that it can just get to work and do its job. And you can be satisfied that you have a big colony of yeast you're putting in there. If it's the yeast amount in the first place that is the problem, that will absolutely fix it. Sometimes it's just not going to work. Maybe it is a problem with your honey, where your honey is just really too acidic for the amount of honey you're putting in there to do the job. There are some varietals of honey, like basswood, for example, is notoriously acidic. I've not had a situation, I've used basswood a couple times, and I've not had a situation where it was too acidic to like actually get the yeast fermenting. But, you know, if somebody says, oh yeah, I have a really acidic honey, that's a possibility. That could happen. Another thing to think about is look at your ingredients. So if you're using apple juice from the store, make sure there's no preservatives in that. Sorbate will kick your butt. And from what I've been told, you can get around that by adding things like the bicarbonate or Camden, maybe. I need to look back into that because I just generally avoid
I
those in the
avoid
first
those the
place.
problem in the first place. I'd
Yeah,
rather dodge
yeah.
the problem than fight it after it's going.
Yeah, no, I've seen, so I saw a video on where, the guy made the Mountain Dew mead.
Yeah, I saw that. The moment I saw it, he goes, I'm going to make mead of Mountain Dew. I'm sitting here, no, why? If you want a mead flavor, if you want a Mountain Dew flavored mead, get the citrus, get the flavors, get the flavonoids, and add it to your mead.
Yeah.
And so I don't have to fight.
I think the problem with that, though, is that if you make a mead with orange flavor and lime flavor and
Grapefruit flavor and
right and things like that, and you make it that way, and then you carbonate it and make it really nice, it's not going to taste like Mountain Dew because it's going to taste better than Mountain Dew.
that sounds like a tragedy. I mean, I'm reeling from the blow here.
I know, right? I'm not a Mountain Dew fan. I don't drink a lot of soda in the first
No, me
place.
either.
But I would rather have something that tastes a lot like those fruity, citrusy flavors than just Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
But the problem that I was talking about there is that, he's got there's a lot of acidity in Mountain Dew. There's a lot of preservatives in Mountain Dew, and he was doing that by raising the pH above 4. The problem is that does create an opportunity for things like botulinum toxins to accumulate from a bacterial thing. Because generally the pH being in that 3 to 4 range also stops a lot of bacteria from getting into your must and getting kind of taking over when the yeast is doing its thing. Yeast is a lot more, I'm sorry, fermentation is a lot more forgiving than other microbiological processes like bacterial ferments or the mycology of growing mushrooms and stuff like that, because it exists in its little window environment where it has home field advantage.
Okay, I want to bring up something that you said time and time again, but it was very understated. When you're checking your hydrometer over the course of 3 days or so, you have time.
Yes.
This is not an urgent thing that you have to fix right now.
Right.
I'm going to make this clear. I'm looking at the microphone when I'm saying this because this is a patience game. Making meads and wines are patience.
It really is. And I think, we might talk about like the differences between making beer and making mead and making wine and things like that in a future episode. But I feel like a lot of the making beer is work up front, and a lot of the making mead is kind of a progressive
Yeah, slow, steady
noticing.
thing.
Yeah, you gotta keep an eye on this, you gotta keep an eye on that, and you gotta be ready to do little tweaks and adjustments along the way.
Yeah, but we have said time and again, we don't we the yeast does the workload.
It really does.
We're just kind of the coach saying go here, go there.
At best case, we're like the shepherd leading the sheep,
Yeah.
telling them where to go.
So, if you're having a stall or a problem, for the most part, you have a little time. Now, I'm not saying always because I've had batches completely fail me with a bacteria invasion. And it sucks, and I cried, and I threw it out, and I moved on. But for the most part, if you're having minor issues like a stall, and that is, I would call that a minor issue because it's correctable
Right.
easily and without damaging your end results. You have time. Take the steps, be patient with yourself, and say, yes, this is not what I wanted, but this can be fixed. So yeah, but that yeah, that's one thing I wanted to bring up because we said it low key,
Right.
but I want you to understand if you're doing this kind of thing, just because these things are happening doesn't mean you did a bad thing, doesn't mean you did anything wrong. It just simply says something wasn't quite right.
There are lots of ways you can try to fix a stall. And in the worst case scenario, when forever, for whatever reason, you have a situation where, you try to get the yeast to ferment, but it's stuck at like 1060, and you've got another like 4 to 6% ABV you could be pulling out of this.
You sure you want it?
You might end up with a big batch of very sweet mead. There's one final way you can correct that without fixing the stall.
How's that?
Make an equally sized batch of dry mead and blend the
And
two.
blend the two. Okay, well, there you go.
Because if you start with something way too sweet And then you get something very dry.
And you get semi-sweet-ish.
In the middle.
Yeah. And honestly, and I will tell you, and I it took me actually about 2.5 years to realize this. The mead will wait for you.
Yeah.
The mead will absolutely wait for you. And I learned that because I got injured. And I was getting ready to bottle, you know, finish off and bottle mead before, just before the day after was the plan. I got injured. Mm-hmm. I got injured the day before. And it was months and months before I get back to it.
Yeah.
And it was just fine.
Keep your sanitation good. Keep your airlocks filled. And, you know, you've eliminated almost all your vectors for contamination. So the yeast will kind of do what it's doing and just long-term age.
There you go. And I was inadvertently doing a slight batch age, but that was, you know, but 4 to 6 months of batch age didn't hurt me at all.
No, generally, it just kind of lets flavors mellow and get friendly with each other, and they work just fine.
Yeah.
As long as, again, you know, you eliminate most of the factors for contamination, you're good.
Yeah.
You're solid.
And, but, you know, the there you go. You know, we're not here to make you feel like, oh my gosh, I got to do this and this and this. No, this is not what we do.
No.
You know, we have families, we have things we do, we have other hobbies, but mead is something we truly enjoy, and you can do it too. And relax. If you're getting stressed out over mead, just take a step back. You're not doing it right, because the meads can wait.
Yeah, have a home brewer, just relax and, you know, step away from it. Absolutely. If you're getting stressed out over it, because this is supposed to be a fun hobby.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is not your job.
This is not your job.
This is what you do after your job so that you can relax and have fun.
And then you go to your job again.
Right.
So, yeah, anyway, but Jeff, I appreciate coming over. We're going to call this here because we covered everything we wanted to do here.
Yeah, I think we've got pretty good coverage on both of those topics there. So,
any questions you have, write them into us. We'd love to hear them. We'd love to answer questions. We do not mind helping you make better media. We're going to learn something from you all at the same time.
Right. We've had some really great episode topics from listener requests, whether it was, you know, a couple weeks ago. I don't even remember the topic off my head now. But yeah, no, we love interacting with you guys. So shoot us a message, info@themeadhouse.com. Reach out to us on Facebook. You know, we are on so many of these directories now. So if you have the opportunity to subscribe and send us a review too, oh my gosh.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
We would appreciate that so much. Anyway, Chris,
Jeff,
have a good one.
You too.